Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdriver, your host. On today's show, Uber settles a lawsuit. What does this mean for Uber and the gig economy as a whole? What does this mean for the ongoing battles about worker classification, whether Uber drivers are independent contractors or employees? Joining me to discuss this is our resident sharing economy commentator and research fellow at the Manhattan Institute, Jared Meyer. Jared, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Evan.
So, Jared, this lawsuit was taking place in both California and Massachusetts. Tell us about the lawsuit, its parameters, and what happened.
Well, what the plaintiffs were arguing, which were all Uber drivers, was that they were wrongly classified as independent contractors instead of employees. So what they wanted was Uber to pay all their work-related expenses that the company would have been on the hook for if they were employees. So for example, all their gas, vehicle maintenance, things like that, and giving them certain employee protections like minimum wage and overtime.
So that's not exactly the outcome that happened because it was a settlement. So while they were searching for that outcome, being classified as employees, Uber settled the case for $84 million, which will be divided among roughly 385,000 drivers in California and Massachusetts, minus $25 million that goes to Shannon Elise Reardon, the attorney who represents these class action drivers and has also been involved in several cases against Silicon Valley companies like Lyft and others that deliver food like Caviar. And so she's going to get a fat $25 million, but the 400,000 drivers, their earnings are not earnings. Their reward is going to be divided based on how much they drove and how much gas they used.
Pretty much around $80 for an average driver.
Oh, well, that's great. So $25 million to the lawyer, $80 to the driver, so much for income equality. But also the $84 million could increase by $16 million depending on the growth of the company, and Uber is likely to go public soon, so this settlement might have had something to do with that. But in addition to the settling and saying that, okay, you can divide up this money, is there an outcome here that actually says anything about whether Uber was right or whether the attorney and the drivers were right?
I'd say if it says anything, it says that Uber was right. And we could see this when Lyft settled a lawsuit recently, too, that a judge actually just dismissed and sent him back to the drawing board. But whenever these companies are settling, it's pretty much showing that they're right. This is not a lot of money for these large, successful, high valuation companies who are looking to go public. But what is a risk to them is maybe the 5% chance that some judge decides that, hey, you know what, you actually should have classified your drivers as employees, especially when companies like Uber are looking to go public very soon. So to just put this behind them, in terms of these specific cases, that's something Uber was willing to pay, you know, almost possibly $95 or $94 million to do.
For a company that's valued at $60 billion, I guess you could say that $84 million is a drop in the bucket to pave the way for a smooth going public and to avoid that 5% chance, which could be absolutely catastrophic. I mean, if a judge ruled that all the drivers in the entire country, some like half a million drivers per month that drive for Uber, if they were all employees, that cost would be certainly a lot more than $84 million.
Oh, of course. And it is important to keep in mind that this isn't some fringe question that may just cost Uber a little bit of money. If Uber drivers were classified as employees, or if Airbnb hosts, or you TaskRabbit taskers, you could go down the list. If any of these people were classified as employees, it would completely destroy the sharing economy's model, which is built on flexibility and individuals deciding when they want to work and really dictating how much they want to work. So taking away that, which is what these lawsuits would do if they were ever successful, would completely destroy the sharing economy. It's important to keep that in mind.
So as with any settlement, the company admits no wrongdoing. It kind of just says, all right, great, go away. Here's $84 million. But in this case, Uber drivers will continue to remain independent contractors, but does this mean that future lawsuits around the same question will be dismissed because this one was settled?
Oh, not at all. No, this carries no legal precedent. So while there may be some sort of precedent of now Uber is going to settle more, or lawyers can expect, hey, I'm just going to take these cases to all the other sharing economy companies and they'll end up settling, there is no legal precedent. And I see so much on blogs or people even writing for semi-respected outlets where they talk about how this was a huge win for Uber because now its biggest existential threat is over. No, it's just these two cases. Nothing stopping Lise Reardon from bringing another case in a different district against Uber, or going and doing what she's doing and just applying these cookie cutter cases to every single sharing economy company so she can keep getting $1 million payouts like this $25 million one.
Yeah, I mean, there's no shortage of companies to target for this question. And because there is this really gray area that the gig economy has created, where we have the independent contractor model, which might not be 100% appropriate, but it is the most logical, given that the alternative is something that just makes no sense. Because if you can drive whenever you want and you own your own vehicle, and other than some technologically neutral aspects of the platform, like the fares that Uber sets and the percentage they take, you really are in control. So to call that person an employee would really throw that entire model out the window. But it's kind of crazy to think that this case doesn't mean anything in the long run. I mean, other than the driver's getting $80 and on average, and the lawyer getting $25 million, and Uber getting to continue operating as with the independent contractor model, there's nothing stopping her from just doing this again and forum shopping and finding other courts where she can get even more money. And this really does, I guess you're right in that all this does is set a precedent about settlements. It basically signals to every single opportunistic lawyer in the country who wants to extract ransom payments from gig economy companies to say, hey, this is a great way to make a lot of money. And it's even better if you don't get the precedent. And we were talking about this in the pre-show, that it would actually be worse for the lawyers if the judge said, yes, you're right, case closed. Can you explain that? Why that would actually be more soft for a lawyer like Miss Lise Reardon?
Well, then she wouldn't be able to really keep settling as much. And if this does go to trial, like I said, it is very, very likely that Uber drivers, all the other sharing economy company workers would end up being independent contractors, not employees, at least under current federal labor law. The Department of Labor is doing everything it can to try to shift that balance towards the employee status. But as of right now, there's really no honest way people can make a reading of the Fair Labor Standards Act or the six-part economic realities test or all these other things that are used to determine this and somehow say that Uber drivers are employees. So what works best for Lise Reardon and all these other class action attorneys is simply to bring these companies into court and settle as soon as they can so that they get their payouts. And I should point out, I talked to every Uber driver I take. I mean, I know this isn't a scientific survey, but I haven't found a single one that wants to join a union. So it's not as if all these Uber drivers are raising up and banding together and demanding that Uber starts treating them exactly like employees. It is, as you said, opportunistic attorneys.
Yeah, and to be fair to the Uber drivers, I mean, who's going to turn down an opportunity to get some amount of money, even if it's just $80, if it's not going to affect you? Uber's not going to retaliate against the drivers and start kicking them off the platform. I mean, that would just be a PR disaster and probably would have some legal issues there. So, I mean, you could be an Uber driver that's very positive towards the company or very negative. It doesn't matter. If you get an email saying you're part of a class action and you have an opportunity to get in on some money, why would you say no? So it's we cannot assume that 385,000 Uber drivers are all up in arms, you know, with the pitchforks and torches and, you know, trying to burn down the castle. They're just, hey, $80, sure, why not? You know, and I'll just keep going on as I would.
Yeah, and those are ones, the class that's been established, this isn't even people who have sent in all the paperwork then. You were automatically made a part of the class. Then what you typically do is assume about 50% fulfillment. So the $80 is assuming about half of people actually fill it out. So if every driver in the class filled it out, it'd be even lower for the average payout.
Now, of course, there was another outcome from this case that was kind of like a form of regulation through lawsuit. So there are ways to regulate companies, you know, in the traditional way. You have the Department of Labor, which can issue regulations. You have Congress, you have state and local governments, you have presidents, and you have governors and mayors. But in this case, we have kind of a concession process through the case. So in addition to paying out $84 million, the company has agreed to change some of its policies, which will actually affect all the drivers, whereas the small amount of money that they might get through the settlement doesn't really do much maybe to change their lives. But Jared, can you talk a little bit about the policy changes that Uber has made and what do you think's behind that?
Yeah, so Uber's realized that drivers do have some legitimate complaints. As I said earlier, drivers don't want to join a union or be employees on a whole, but a lot of them are angry that they really don't have a voice and that they can be dismissed without any warning, without even being told they were doing something wrong. So Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber, he said they've done a lot since the company's been created, but they haven't always been right. And on this issue, which he gave on in the settlement, he decided that now we need to let drivers know when they're coming close to being deactivated. Let them know that this is on the wrong path and it's going to make them lose their status so that they have some warning and they can defend themselves against claims. Because maybe you just had a string of four really drunk, angry people in a row who all gave you one star. You should have a chance to kind of defend yourself from that. So that's one of the changes that was made. And the other one is now drivers can solicit tips from riders. One of my favorite things about Uber was there was no awkward tipping process at the end. And Uber always said you should expect a 5-star ride. That is the standard. That's not an exception. So they just never did tipping and drivers made more than taxi drivers anyways. But now they're going to allow drivers to post signs and solicit tips from riders. So I know my Uber rating is going to drop pretty drastically because I'm not going to start tipping because I think that's stupid. We should expect a good ride. I don't get tipped every time I do a podcast. I mean, I know I don't do as good as some drivers do, but I just don't understand this need to tip when it's so easily taken care of electronically and we've got the payment. They're making more money than taxi drivers. So those are the two big changes. Drivers get some warning and now they can start hassling you for tips.
And look, you may think that tipping for an electronically enabled ride like Uber is dumb, but if you disagree with that and you think that tipping is great, you have a couple options. I know Maureen Dowd of the New York Times, this is just an anecdote, but she talked about in a column how she would always keep her drivers waiting and she was worried that she was going to get a shitty rating and get kicked off the platform for keeping her drivers waiting. And time is money. So keeping a driver waiting could actually cost them, it could decrease their average hourly wage. In an effort to combat that and also lead to her getting a better rating, she would give cash tips. She would bring cash into the car and while the transaction happened automatically on her credit card or whatever, she would then give some cash to the driver, and that's perfectly fine. I don't think maybe Uber before the court case and the settlement that we're talking about on this show before, they would tell drivers not to solicit tips, but I don't think there was any rule saying, okay, if someone's handing you a couple bills, you can't take it, right?
Yeah, and now it's becoming that I'm worried it's going to become the norm where you have to tip, where it's like taxi drivers. I mean, I've had terrible rides in taxis where I'm like, I'm just not going to tip them. And the drivers have literally swore at me when I was leaving. I'm like, you got me lost. It took 20 times longer to get me here. You're not getting a tip. So just the idea that, I don't know. I just have a problem with it. Maybe it'll work for some drivers, but all I know is my rating's going to get a lot lower because I'm not going to start tipping unless if a driver puts up with like five of my drunk friends in a car.
Hey, and there's competition in this market and there are differentiating factors. So Lyft, Uber's biggest, most prominent competitor, allows tipping.
Through the app too.
Right. So when you take an Uber ride, your card is automatically charged immediately after the ride. In contrast with Lyft, there is this gap period where it might take, you don't see the email receipt for a while because when you open the app, it's giving you an opportunity to add in, you know, there's some preset options like $1, $2, $5, or you can add as much as you want. And that is a differentiating factor for Lyft. And maybe people who use Lyft use it for that reason. They say, I want to tip my drivers. I want to have some control over what I pay. I want to reward good service and not reward bad service. This lawsuit, it's very likely that Uber will adopt the exact same model as Lyft because it's convenient. Whereas putting in some type of cash situation really goes against the whole model of ease and convenience. It's very likely, and some have speculated, that Uber will just implement their competitor's model. Now, maybe that's great in some people's eyes, but maybe not, because you've now taken away one of Lyft's competitive advantages as the smaller company that's trying to differentiate itself.
Yeah, and I guess it's just the whole point of, I think there are changes Uber needs to make to its model, and they have been making changes. I mean, it's a growing, innovative new model. So going through the lawsuit process like this, maybe it's not the best way, but another change was that Uber's creating these so-called drivers councils, which are pretty much, they don't have any power, but they can go to Uber's management and talk with them about what drivers are concerned about. I really don't see any downside in this. You know, it's a great way. You're not going to be able to grow and have a successful company if you don't have, first of all, a lot of customers, but also a lot of quality drivers. So all of these could help. I'm not a big fan of the tipping, but it's something that could change. And I guess the most important thing is, at least for the next few months, Uber's business model will stay intact, but Lise Reardon's going to be right back at it again in a different district, and we're maybe one day going to finally get a ruling that will clarify that its sharing economy workers are independent contractors, not employees.
And Uber has recognized that it's made some mistakes in the way that it's reacted to bad press and the way that it's reacted to driver concerns. I mean, and surely even in the most libertarian person can realize that a company needs to do certain things to treat its drivers well, to treat the customers well, that there's part of a responsibility there to uphold your image, to have a good reputation. And certainly the image that Uber kind of got, whether fair or not, was that it was this like aggressive capitalist, you know, just completely motivated by profits with tunnel vision, you know, Ayn Rand, just go into a city, ignore the regulations, get a bunch of customers and then pay the fines. And certainly that's attractive to a lot of free market people, but they've realized that in this mixed economy we have, we don't have the fully capitalist system. You have to deal with regulators. You have to deal with public opinion. You have to deal with courts. So part of the changes to the driver policies and allowing for associations and allowing for tipping, part of this is a recognition that they didn't always handle things in the best way, and there's certainly room for growth. But it's important to remind people this company is 6 years old, or maybe 7 years old. This idea of the internet-enabled gig economy is not that old. So there are going to be blunders. There are going to be trial and error processes, and we cannot expect that there is one model that we can just create and just impose it on the entire gig economy, and that'll just fix all the problems. Think about how long it took to get factory regulations right, to get child labor laws right, to get all these things right. These things take time, and it's going to be messy, and there are going to be blunders, and we have to be willing to accept that if we want to avoid something like just classify them all as employees and impose the taxi model on Uber.
Yeah, and one important thing to keep in mind is you hear how valuable Uber is every time it does a new round of fundraising, it just goes up and up. But Uber is not really turning a profit in the United States. It'll be close to about break even according to its projections this year, but it's still losing a lot of money abroad. If you make a change that's all of a sudden going to make it twice as expensive for the company, they're not going to be able to pay their drivers the same or have their drivers be able to make as much money. They'll have to take a larger cut. So this is all about trade-offs. You have to find a point at which riders are willing to take this service and really embrace it, but also people are willing to drive. It's a constant back and forth. And what really annoys me is whenever you hear about this debate, especially on the federal level, progressive politicians tend to only focus on the drivers. Like, where is the discussion to the consumer benefits? All the past few topics we've been talking about with lawsuits or debates over Uber, they're all about employees or their drivers or the independent contractors. Like, let's talk about all the benefits to consumers. People need to keep that in mind and not just focus on one crazed class action lawyer's crusade against the sharing economy.
Right. And it's important to point out that Uber is worth $60 billion, so it can afford to do things like this. Lyft, you know, much lower valuation, but still one of the deeper pocketed companies in the gig economy. Let's talk about some companies that can't pay out $100 million ransoms to lawyers. You've got a bunch of cases in arbitration on the exact same question of whether someone who delivers groceries through an app or drives through an app is an independent contractor or an employee. And as we mentioned before, this case has done nothing to settle that question, which leaves the door open to all these other ones. So you've got companies like Instacart, Handy, Postmates, Caviar, Grubhub, they're all pending in litigation. They're all wrapped up. And these are companies that are all smaller than Uber. And there's one that I'd like to mention, which is HomeJoy, because HomeJoy was a house cleaning service that would pair house cleaners with people who wanted that service, similar to a lot of gig economy services. Their case didn't even finish because they just filed for bankruptcy in the middle of the litigation. They were just like, we cannot afford this. It's done. So see ya. Class action lawsuit killed an entire company. So there are some serious dangers here. And while it might be easy for Uber to keep paying out, this type of situation where lawyers are just forum shopping, going to court to see where they can win and extract some rent from a company, that won't shut down a company like Uber, but it might discourage other companies from getting into this business model. It might discourage competition to Uber and Lyft, and it might just have the effect of entrenching incumbents, of saying that whoever happens to be the players now, that's who's going to be the market leaders. And that's really unfortunate because we want more competition. We want Uber to face stiffer competition. We want a robust gig economy. And if these lawsuits continue, it might just say, nope, you've got two driving companies and that's it. You've got one food delivery company and that's it, because only one company can survive the onslaught of lawsuits.
Yeah, and I'm really interested to see how some of these other cases turn out, because as you pointed out, there's some companies that can't even afford to litigate this, but there's other ones that can't afford to settle for the amounts that, you know, greedy lawyers want. So maybe we will finally get a ruling, and that will embolden Lyft or Uber to actually stand up and follow Walmart's strategy where they never settle and they fight everything. That would kind of be the path forward I'd like to see, where Uber and Lyft make these concessions to give the drivers some of what they want on their own. And then they fight these cases and say, hey, this is not our business model. You are completely mischaracterizing what our drivers want. And you just frankly do not understand what's going on in today's economy.
And this might really reignite the debate about a third way, because I mentioned earlier that maybe the independent contractor model is not 100% appropriate. Maybe there is a difference between someone going house to house to cut hair, using Craigslist to find customers, as opposed to someone who uses a platform that has a lot of restrictions. You know, you can only charge what Uber allows you to charge for the drive. You can only, you know, there are some aspects of the platform that make it maybe more employee-like than an independent contractor, but there might be a need for a third way here, because what some of the models that we've talked about on other shows, in exchange for Uber and Lyft and companies like that creating a private pooled benefits market for drivers, or allowing them to get health insurance in a group or things like that to kind of address the shortcomings of the independent contractor model, which involve not having benefits, not having some of those workers' comp, things like that. In exchange for that, the companies would be shielded from liability. That is the idea, that in order to avoid these very potentially destructive lawsuits, the companies will do some things in exchange that will benefit drivers. I mean, do you think that this lawsuit will reignite that debate, or do you think that the quote unquote third way is the way forward to avoid this case by case settlement and lack of precedent?
In a perfect world, I think the third way could be a positive path forward. First of all, everyone who's honest or knows what's going on agrees that wage and hour protection should not apply to people like Uber drivers. I mean, how does minimum wage factor in? You could just sit at your house with the Uber app on and not accept any rides and get paid, or you could be driving for Uber and Lyft at the same time. Also, overtime, you pick your own hours. Why would overtime matter? So some things like those, they just clearly do not apply. But there is a debate over things such as civil rights protection that make it, you know, more difficult to get rid of employees, and stronger protections for more classes of people. That's a debate. Some people think collective bargaining should be extended to Uber drivers so that they could just join a union if over half of a similar class wanted to do so. I think that's just as pointless as wage and hour protections. I mean, all Uber drivers work for themselves. They're independent contractors. They run pretty much their own business. Why would you have to join a union, be forced to join a union, if you didn't want to, just because over half of your class voted to do so? I mean, there's some people who work 5 hours a week on Uber, others who work 50 hours. They have different ideas of what they want from the company, and that should be maintained.
Right.
But on the third way, I think The thing to keep in mind is this is something that would have to go through Congress, and nothing's going to happen before the election. I doubt anything's going to happen in the first year. So this is more of a long-term process. But in the short term, what I would really like is for Congress to just pass something that will stop the Department of Labor from shifting the scales towards employees. And this way, then we can stay in the current system, which is obviously working a lot better than completely upending the sharing economy. Then we can have a larger debate about the future of work that even goes far beyond just the third way.
Certainly, while minimum wage and things like that might not be appropriate, you know, having a portable benefits package a healthcare plan that when I drive for Uber and then I switch to Lyft and then I switch to Instacart and then I switch to being a handyman or whatever, that health insurance plan travels with me. That idea could be really attractive as a way to avoid these lawsuits, because while the lawyers might be motivated just by extracting rent from the companies, maybe drivers really do just want to increase their flexibility by having a flexible healthcare plan.
Yeah, and I should point out the CEOs, if I want to say 30 sharing economy companies, all signed a letter saying they'd be open to offering these flexible benefits that their workers want. But the problem is, if they did so currently, all they're doing is making themselves look more and more like employers. Right. And it will make it easier for these class actions to actually be decided adversely. So opening up something like that, I think there's wide agreement on that front, except for people who the only reason they want the employee status is for unionization. They're not willing to give on something common sense like that, because that's a good bargaining chip they currently possess.
Well, that's it for today's show. We'll certainly be tracking all of these lawsuits, and we'll probably be having Jared back on the show to discuss them, because they're not going anywhere anytime soon. And look out next month for Jared's book. It's called Uber Positive, Why Americans Love the Sharing Economy. We'll probably have him on the show to talk about that. But Jared, thank you for joining us again.
Hey, thanks for having me, Evan.
Follow us on Twitter at Tech Freedom or on Facebook.com/Tech Freedom. Find this podcast in the iTunes store on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will help us and help others find the show. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.